Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1102. Fascism 2019 World Tour, Part 12, Further Reflections on the Pivot Point. This is being recorded on December 3rd of the year 2019. There is a lot going on, and the one part of me feels frustrated by the fact that, a very large part of me feels frustrated at not being able to include more in an hour's worth of broadcast. However, with what is taking place not only in Europe and Ukraine and the continued fevered propagation of the Russiagate psyop in this country, and also with the destabilization of China, I think focusing on the world island, or Earth Island as it is called, and geopolitics will shed some further light on what is going on with impeachment. Before getting into further discussion of Ukraine or the pivot point, as Sir Halford Mackinder and later Zbigniew Brzezinski called it, that it being Ukraine, do note that the Deutsche Bank official in charge of that bank's operations that were in connection with Donald Trump's records allegedly committed suicide a few days ago. This after Deutsche Bank conveniently lost some of Donald Trump's records. There is speculation that they were destroyed. And I would also note that Trump's attorneys have argued that Donald Trump could indeed do what he sarcastically joked about during the 2016 campaign. He joked that he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for him. They were arguing that he could indeed shoot somebody, but that he could not be invited while he was a seated president. The death of Mr. Bowers of Deutsche Bank and the destruction of the records and Trump's attorneys basically arguing that as long as he was president, he could murder people with impunity is worth talking about. And we are going to do that. Do note that there is a case on appeal. There's a court case which may very well go up to the Supreme Court that will involve Deutsche Bank and those documents. Recall that Justice Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin, was in charge of Deutsche Bank's real estate lending division and then was ultimately transferred. But it is worth noting that that came out in Justice Trump, Justice Kennedy resigned from the Supreme Court to be replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. So the courts, the Supreme Courts and Donald Trump and Deutsche Bank and cover-ups and missing records and dead people are all figuring into the vortex that is whirling around the black hole of American politics and jurisprudence. Watching observing the proceedings vis-a-vis impeachment and Trump, and I don't think there is any way in hell that the Republican-controlled Senate is going to vote to convict Trump. The Democratic-controlled House will in all probability return articles of impeachment. That is, if it can be done before the next election and if the Democrats can retain control of the House. It is bitterly amusing to me to watch the Democrats adhering feverishly to the Russiagate nonsense. Watching the Republicans versus the Democrats, for me, is like watching Nazi Germany versus Vichy France, with Vichy France being the Democrats and Nazi Germany being the Republicans. It is grotesque. But recall that what this was about was Donald Trump attempting to get President Zelensky of Ukraine to look into Hillary Clinton's PAC records and various things. But the real focal point was an investigation of Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, and his relationship with the Burisma natural gas company in Ukraine. Recall that Ukraine has the largest proven natural gas reserves in Europe, incorrectly reported by a CNN article as the world. It is apparently Europe, not the world. And as we will see later, the Central European energy, including natural gas dynamics, is one of the foundational elements of the revived Intermarium concept. We're going to talk about that, perhaps time permitting, later. But what really got Donald Trump in trouble with the deep state was attempting to withhold military aid to Ukraine and in exchange for, basically said, we'll provide military aid if you investigate Hunter Biden. It was Trump's withholding of military aid that led to the whistleblowing and all of the frothing at the mouth and gesticulating that we have seen. Trump could pretty much do anything. In fact, his attorneys have argued that he could shoot somebody but could not be indicted while a seated president. But it is Trump's crossing of a very, very deep political concept, that of the pivot point, or Ukraine as it is known to us, and the control of that key area by Western interests at one level and fascist interests at another. This is related to the concept of the Earth Island, and time permitting, we will go into that. I'm going to take a look. We are going to take a look at some of the deep history of Ukraine and the OUN, Ukrainian Fascist Organization, its collaboration with other White Russian and Eastern European fascist elements between the wars, and how Stalin's pact, a non-aggression pact with Hitler in 1939, which permitted Stalin and the Red Army to occupy part of Poland, led elements of the OUN, who had been collaborating with Nazi Germany, to opt instead for a British and American sponsored effort at establishing an intermarium, the Central and Eastern European political consortium that was originally seen by Polish President Józef Piłsudski as a barrier against both German and Russian expansion. It morphed between the world wars due in large part to the pivotal role of Ukrainian nationalists and fascists in the Intermarium, into basically an Axis collaborationist and Western collaborationist element in the Second World War and the subsequent Cold War. It has morphed into the OUNB successor organizations and their domination of the political and national security establishments of Ukraine today. We should note in passing, because we have spoken at length about the virulent fascist nature of elements controlling the Ukrainian intelligence service, their military, their police, Volodymyr Vyatrovich, at one point Minister of Education, the laws passed in Ukraine, basically making it a criminal offense to recount the basic history of both the OUN and its military wing, the UPA, as extensions of and allies of the Third Reich's military and intelligence apparatus. As far as can be determined, given the media lockdown on telling the truth about what is going on in the pivot point or Ukraine, the vast majority of Ukrainian people do not appear to be supportive of the OUND organizations like Pravi Sector, Svoboda and others, the Azov Battalion and its associated organizations. However, they are, when you control the police and the military and the intelligence agencies, and when you have laws passed that make it a crime to tell the truth, and when the Minister of Education is an overt pro-Axis revisionist, as Mr. Viatrovich is, well, there is not a lot that you can do. So by way of understanding the deep politics of the pivot point, Ukraine, we're going to turn to a book that we have used in the past. It's called American Swastika by Charles Higham. It was published in 1935 by Doubleday and Company and copyrighted by Charles Higham. The discussion here is about white Russians and period between the Second World War, the First and Second World Wars, various anti-communist or quote white unquote organizations were operating in conjunction with one another. They were operating in conjunction with German intelligence to destroy ultimately the Soviet Union following a proposed German invasion of the Soviet Union. When, as I said, when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed, this led many Ukrainian fascists who had been allied with Third Reich Intelligence to turn against Third Reich Intelligence, at least for the time being, and to seek support from Britain and the U.S., whom they saw as more reliable allies, in establishing an intermarium, and we're going to take a look at that. In addition to looking at Mr. Pelepenko and his turning against Third Reich Intelligence and support for a version of what we know to be the intermarium, the term is not used here. Note also the collaboration between various Eastern and Central European fascist groups, including Lithuanian and the Romanian Iron Guard, as well as the Armenian fascists, the Tashnags, with the OUND and other Ukrainian fascist organizations. Note also something we spoke about in AFA 14, and something we have come back to, that namely the pan-Turkist participation in the Promethean League and the Intermarium networks. Later they also became a key element of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And we have, again, spoken about that in a number of programs, including AFA 14. We'll touch on that in the description for this program. Luzi Nazar, an ethnic Uzbek, as I recall, was part of the pan-Turkist milieu that was alive with Nazi Germany. He fought with the Durlewanger Brigade and later represented the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations at their Dallas conference at the Dallas conference in 1984. He was reported, that is to say, Ruzi Nazar, named Nazarov, was reported by the Arizona Republic to be a liaison with the National Action Party of Alparslan Turkesh, one of whose youth members, Mehmet Ali Aja, shot the Pope.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, of the OUNB and the related organizations UHO and ODWU and their collaboration with Third Reich intelligence and their activities inside of the U.S. This in conjunction with Lithuanian, Romanian Iron Guard fascists and also Pan-Perkists, we read as follows in American Swastika. Alfred Rosenberg, by the way, was the in charge of the Ostministerium, or the ministry for Eastern European politics for the Third Reich. He was an ethnic Balt. Alfred Rosenberg was the chief inspiration for the American White Russian groups led by the Organization for Rebirth of the Ukraine, better known as ODWU, and the Ukrainian Hetman Organization, or UHO. The concern of these organizations, which were keenly supported by Boris Brasol, B-R-A-S-O-L, was the recapturing of the Ukraine from the Soviet Union. By the way, Brasol, someone we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 and FTR 511, he appears to have been one of the liaisons between Henry Ford and Adolf Hitler, helping to channel monies from the famed American industrialist Henry Ford to Adolf Hitler. One more time. The concern of these organizations, which were keenly supported by Boris Brasol, was the recapturing of the Ukraine from the Soviet Union. Meetings of the Control Commission of the Ukrainian National Organization, or OUN, were held at 83 Grand Street, Jersey City, and were heavily attended by leaders of the Ukrainian community. By 1940, the association had a membership of 40,000 people, all operating under former leaders of the White Guard, a terrorist Tsarist organization that committed acts of violence, murder, and the spoliation in Poland and the Balkans. The directing body, or PROVID, which worked directly with the Abwehr and with the Auslandsorganisation, or AO, had a string of special liaison officials bound to their duties by a sacred oath who threaded through free nations of the world spreading their doctrines and subversive plans. In the late 1930s, terrorist leaders of the ODWU, including leaders of the German army specializing in espionage operations, arrived in the U.S. and were granted residency when many Jews had difficulty in squeezing through the needle's eye of the State Department Visa Division. By 1940, following a series of clandestine meetings across the nation, the leader of the ODWU in the U.S. was Monsignor Ivan Buchko, B-U-C-H-K-O, head of the Ukrainian Catholic Church at 22 East 7th Street, New York. Despite the fact that his activities on behalf of the Nazis had resulted in his removal even from countries like Argentina and Uruguay, he was admitted back to the U.S. and had no further problems with either Breckinridge Long of the Visa Division or Major Lemuel Schofield of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The Hetman, was particularly influential in Detroit. It is not surprising that a special assistant to Harry Bennett of Ford Motor Company was one of the Hetmans at the time when Bennett was working closely with Father Coughlin to infiltrate labor unions. The German-American Bund under Gerhard Wilhelm Kunz paid funds into the UHO and the reliable German Library of Information at 17 Battery Place supplied much propaganda material for distribution. A keen admirer of the UHO and the ODWU was Joseph P. Camp, the proselytizer, editor, and publisher and sponsor of the Nazi sympathizer Major General Van Horn Moseley, who later became a supporter and intimate friend of Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. Of course, McCarthy's right-hand man was Roy Cohn, who was a political mentor to and attorney for Donald Trump. Continuing. Meanwhile, leaders of the ODWU and the UHO besieged Hitler with telegrams of approval of his every move. The organizations had contacts in the army. In late 1940, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists moved to Rome, where a correspondent of the official Ukrainian fascist newspaper Svoboda of Jersey City was the payment of funds supplied in the U.S. All members of the organization in Germany were in the Gestapo or the regular army from the moment war broke out in Europe. They kept up constant contact with their American associates. The Ukrainian Catholic Diocese gave support to the organization, and when a representative went to New York City as an auxiliary authorized by Cardinal Spellman, he actually began promoting the ODWU and the UHO through Catholic journals. The organizations raised substantial funds to support the large number of Ukrainian Americans who were opposed to their activities. The Ukrainian Mutual Aid Society held a meeting in New York City on October 19, 1940, demanding the ejection of the ODWU and the UHO from Ukrainian circles. The members insisted that unless the Ukrainian National Association purged itself of all pro-Nazi elements, they would split off permanently from the UNA. Letters were drawn up, signed by all members, insisting on the outlawing of the extremists. They were backed by the liberal newspaper PN and by Albert E. Kahn's weekly newsletter, The Hour. In December of 1940, with the matter not resolved, a member of the British appeasement group, which was lobbying for negotiated peace with Hitler, made contact with Svoboda's editor in Canada. The paper had been banned in Canada. The agent told him that he represented Lord Halifax, who was shortly to become British ambassador to Washington about a month earlier, at a meeting at the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco. Sir William Wiseman of the investment firm Kuhn Loeb had discussed with the Princess Stephanie von Hohenlohe and Nazi Consul Fritz Wiedemann Lord Halifax's role in a proposed negotiated peace between Britain and Germany. By the way, Princess Hohenlohe and Prince Egon Max von Hohenlohe are part of the same family. It was Prince von Hohenlohe who was acting as a mediator between Alan Dulles and the Nazi SS. We looked at that actually in our last series of programs. We've done it in a number of them, and including our last the previous four shows dealing with Intermarium, continuing the aforementioned Boris Vassil, an apparent a white Russian who was an apparent link between Henry Ford and Adolf Hitler. Boris Vassil was in support of the fascists. On January 26, 1941, he published in the newspaper Rossiya, R-O-S-S-I-Y-A, an open letter to radio station WEAF in New York City, attacking the Fred Waring Orchestra for ruining the old Russian national anthem to the commercial, 40 million Americans are smoking Chesterfields. Vassil condemned the jazzing up of the hymn as part of a Bolshevik plot and threatened a Russian-American boycott of the well-known brand of cigarette. In March of 1941, the Ukrainian press service in Rome increased supplies of propaganda to the U.S. In one bulletin, it bragged that ODWU members in Argentina, operating directly under the Nazis, had sunk several British ships. Other missives from Rome attacked the ODWU critics in both The Hour and PM magazine. But Albert E. Kahn of the former publication obtained a document in booklet form with photographs showing a UHO convention in Berlin in which the members gave the Nazi salute to a portrait of Hitler. Publication of this information caused embarrassment in Berlin, since the organization was not thought to be as widely exposed as the German-American Bund. There was talk in Nazi circles of disbanding it, but on April 5th, Kahn charged that Ukrainian fascists were responsible for the sabotage of the Pennsylvania Railroad Cleveland to Pittsburgh Express, which caused the death of 5 persons. Other organizations supported the Ukrainians as well. These included Romanian groups connected to the Iron Guard. Support also came from the Armenians in the form of the Tashnags, or Armenian Revolutionary Federationers, who had made a deal with Hitler that he would put them in power when he invaded their Soviet-controlled country. A Tashnag had stabbed to death Archbishop Leon Turian, T-O-U-R-I-A-N, primate of the Armenian Church in America, when he was celebrating Mass in New York on Christmas Eve of 1933, charging that the Archbishop was a Soviet secret agent. The Tashnags had financial and personal links to the Irish and White Russian groups. As early as March 15, 1938, the ODWU organ, The Nationalist, extended an invitation to all Armenian revolutionaries to coordinate their activities with the Ukrainians, and that collaboration continued until the early 1940s. Like the Ukrainians, the Armenian terrorists falsely claimed the support of the whole of their national community. That same month, instead of discrediting the ODWU and the UHO, Nazi Germany issued instructions for Ukrainians to step up their activities. Under orders from Berlin, they infiltrated agents into every industry and the Army, Navy, and Coast Guard, until finally they matched the Irish in being instruments of Nazi subversive efforts. By July of 1941, Ukrainian organizations were financed from Berlin and American sympathizers as well, to the sum of $6 million, by the way, in 1941. That was a whole lot more money than it is now. Through their recording secretary, they retained contact with the Berlin headquarters. They denounced Winston Churchill and Roosevelt for joining forces with the Soviet Union. All through that summer, Ukrainian fifth columnists spread out across the U.S. filming roads, bridges, factories, and military and naval locations. Virtually the whole of Pittsburgh with its mills, railroad yards, and river barges, Detroit and the bridge to Windsor, Ontario, and Lockheed and other airplane plants in California were filmed by the underground groups. By October, they had a grasp of the whole American defense system. They were aided by Lithuanians, who supervised the distribution of Nazi materials in Lithuanian language dailies, bitterly attacking the Red Russians and calling for all Lithuanians to stand shoulder to shoulder against the Soviet Union. The organization worked very closely with the Quisling-type regime in Lithuania, the puppet government set up under the Nazis. The Lithuanians were particularly active in distributing leaflets condemning Germany's enemies in the matter of the invasion of Russia. The Ukrainians had friends everywhere. Even so distinguished a publisher as the Yale University Press published a book, Michael Grushevsky's A History of the Ukraine, which praised the German-Ukrainian Fifth Column in the most extravagant terms and praised Hitler outright. A venomous stream of manifestos poured out of ODWU headquarters as Hitler became an increasing threat to the U.S. and Roosevelt waged an undeclared war in the Atlantic. It was not until after Pearl Harbor that at last the Jewish Henry Morgenthau Jr., Secretary of the Treasury, ordered the freezing of the Ukrainian funds. Then there is discussion of Count Anastasi von Siatsky. We have spoken about him in the past. He was a White Russian and was a key organizer of the White Russian and White Ukrainian fascist fifth column in the U.S. And we have spoken about him in the past.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Something that is worth noting here, a couple of points. Again, note that organizations like the Lithuanian Fascist Organization and also the Iron Guard connected elements were part of this between the wars pro-Axis fifth column in the U.S. Those elements, as well as the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Bulgarian National Front, the Croatian Ustashi, and other Central and Eastern European fascist organizations, then became part of the Galen Organization. They combined under OUN domination in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. They were closely connected to the CIA as well as the BND and evolved into a key element of the Republican Party through the Crusade for Freedom. But also the passing reference here to the Irish. One of the aspects of fascism that is both very important to understand and also something that tends to raise people's hackles, particularly today, is discussing the operation and genesis of fascist organizations during the period of colonialism or overt national colonialism. One could make the case, and a very good case indeed, that corporate colonialism has continued apace with nations using their key transnational corporations to do much the same thing that nations as a whole did to their various colonial properties prior to World War II and to an extent afterward as well. Of course, the enmity between Ireland and their British masters is well documented. Because of the Irish struggle for independence, there was a considerable Axis fifth column among not only people in Ireland, but in the Irish Americans as well. There was actually there were more than one Irish fascist organizations. The well-known poet William Butler Yeats was part of a fascist organization called Celtic Dawn. Perhaps the best known of those organizations were the Blue Shirts, the Irish Blue Shirts. But when one is talking about someone like Subhas Chandra Bose or the various Hindutva fascist organizations, or when one is talking about some of the Pan-Turkist organizations or the Muslim Brotherhood or the fascist element in the Zionist movement, it is important to keep in mind the colonial period and the fact that Germany and Italy, as well as Japan, sought to make common cause with people seeking their liberation from colonialism by basically siding with the Axis. Again, noting that alliance between members of people in countries that were seeking their independence with the fascists, whether it is the RSS in India, the parent organization of Narendra Modi's BJP, or the Likud organization which evolved from Vladimir Yabotinsky's fascists, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which is far more important and which has a huge presence in the U.S., including and especially now in the so-called progressive sector. It is important to keep in mind, again, the colonial period and how that spawned organizations that have evolved to the present time, getting blinded by identity politics and say, well, how can Dave Emery say nasty things about the Irish or about the Arabs or about the Indians or about Israelis and the fascist Zionists, a powerful, though, an element in dominance in Israel at this time, although they may get unseated. Again, it is important to keep in mind the history of fascism and in particular the genesis of these groups during the colonial period when they sought military alliance and political alliance with the Axis powers as a vehicle for obtaining their independence. This is also not to say that many of those organizations also manifested a fascist and racist political outlook, because many of them did that as well. Now, the aforementioned Count Anastasi von Syatsky, a key white Russian operative of the Nazi and fascist underground in the U.S. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention. there was a reference to Harry Bennett of the Ford Motor Company and the fact that a key Ukrainian fascist was a top aide to Harry Bennett. As noted, he was infiltrating labor unions with Father Coughlin, an Axis agent who had a very powerful and effective radio show and a newsletter. Harry Bennett is not someone that we have spoken that much about. He was in charge of what was euphemized as the Ford Personnel Service. I've seen other names for it. What that basically was a private goon squad, an anti-labor cadre of the Ford Motor Company. It was headed up by Harry Bennett at the same time that Harry Bennett was head of the Michigan State Parole Board. And one of the things that he would do is to parole some of the most vicious criminals in the Michigan penitentiary system or the Michigan correctional system out into the service of the Ford Personnel Agency, where they would continue to practice their trade, beating up and murdering union organizers and their families. A very important guy in the history of American fascism, and someone who really has not received a lot of historical recognition. But again, Harry Bennett, very important. The work of George Selby's and his newsletter is something to consult in connection with Harry Bennett. Also some of George Selby's remarkable books as well. Now, as I mentioned, in connection with Count Anastasi von Syatsky, an FBI agent named Percy Foxworth, F-O-X-W-O-R-T-H, was assigned with infiltrating and politically neutralizing Count von Syatsky. He was at a loss as to who he could utilize. And then he came across a guy whom we have spoken about in the past in connection with our discussions with Peter Lavenda and his remarkable book, The Hitler Legacy. This was a Roman Catholic priest from Ukraine, originally a Greek Orthodox priest named Alexei Pelepenko, P-E-L-Y-P-E-N-K-O. Now, he had been part of the Ukrainian fascist infrastructure in Europe and Latin America and the U.S. However, again, they saw Hitler and the German armies as a vehicle for their return inside of the Soviet Union and for the establishing of an independent Ukraine. As it turned out, Ukraine became a puppet state of Nazi Germany during its occupation by the Nazis, and that element spawned the OUNB and other elements that we have spoken about so many times, and they were dominant in the various manifestations of the Intermarium. However, again, when Stalin and Hitler signed their non-aggression pact in the eve of 1939 on the eve of Hitler's invasion of Poland. This gave Stalin and the Soviet Union the right to invade Poland from the east, and that basically put a buffer zone between, at least for the time being, between Stalin's armies and those of Hitler. This was very important to the Ukrainian fascists, or many of them, because many of them were embittered by this, and instead of an alliance with Nazi Germany, some of them sought support from British and American intelligence in establishing what we will recognize as the Intermarium. This was one of the dominant motivating factors for Alexei Pelepenko. Returning again to American swastika by Charles Higham. It occurred to the FBI chief in New York, the hardworking, bullet-headed Percy Foxworth, that it would be difficult to bring the Count, that is, Count Anastasi von Siavsky, in unless some Russian-speaking person could be made to penetrate his circle. Just when Foxworth was wondering whom to hire for the job, the ideal person materialized out of nowhere. This was Alexei, A-L-E-X-E-I, Pelepenko, P-E-L-Y-P-E-N-K-O, a lean, rangy, secretive Roman Catholic priest of Ukrainian birth and Polish adoption, who hated the Nazis for their invasion of Poland and turned against them after working as a Nazi contact in Argentina. Born on February 12, 1893, in Kovalivka in the Ukraine, Pelepenko was originally ordained a Greek Orthodox priest at Ruk, Poland in 1915, then traveled to Warsaw. Clever and accomplished, he was a master of several languages, and from 1933 to 1937, he taught young Nazis at the College of St. Andrew in Munich. The Gestapo suspected him of being a double agent, but had no proof. He was given 3 days to leave the country. In order to avoid prosecution, he arranged for an assignment in Rome, where he made connections to Italian intelligence. He was then assigned to Prague to assist in the arrangements for the German invasion of Czechoslovakia, and in August of 1937, he joined his daughter Hala, H-A-L-A, who was being trained at the French College in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Pelepenko attached himself to the chief of the Gestapo in South America and to the German embassy. Because of his links to white Russians and the German government, he joined the international plot to assist Ukrainians in starting a revolution on the day when Germany would invade Russia. However, and this is key, one more, the last sentence again, because of his links to white Russians and the German government, he joined the international plot to assist Ukrainians in starting a revolution on the day when Germany would invade Russia. However, the action of the Moscow government in moving into East Poland and stopping the German advance and the signing of the pact between Hitler and Stalin caused him and his fellow Ukrainians to lose faith in the Germans carrying out their part of the agreement. He and his colleagues felt that they should throw their lot in with the British and work for the formation of a bloc of Slavic states, including Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, and Ukraine. These colleagues knew that it would be necessary to have British and American support to form the bloc and defend the area from Russian aggression. They also felt that Turkey and Greece could be used as a buffer against Russia. This again, we were recognized as the Intermarium and overlapping the Promethean League that we spoke about in AFA program number 14. One more time, because this is a manifestation of the Intermarium. Eventually, the Ustashi of Croatia, part of what became Yugoslavia briefly, or at least for a while, and the Romanian Iron Guard, the Bulgarian National Front, the OUNB, the Czechoslovakian Link-Up Party, and the Baltic Fascist Parties as well, would to coalesce along with various Pan-Turks, Pan-Turkists, like Ruzi Nazar, named Nazarov, in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. That became one of the key realizations, or one of the key vehicles for realizing a potential Intermarium against initially the Soviet Union and now Russia. One more time. He, Pavlenko, and his colleagues felt that they should throw their lot in with the British, this following the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939, should throw their lot in with the British and work for the formation of a bloc of Slavic states, including Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, and Ukraine. These colleagues knew that it would be necessary to have British and American support to form the bloc and defend the area from Russian aggression. They also felt that Turkey and Greece could be used as a buffer against Russia. Pavlenko decided to cease being a German agent and use the confidence the Nazis had in him to help the Allied cause. He wrote to the FBI in Washington from a new location in Valparaiso, Chile, in 1940, stating that he would like to work underground in the U.S. He was invited to come at once. Arriving at the beginning of 1941, he revealed that the Nazis and the Japanese had designs on the Panama Canal. He said that the Polish army stationed in Iran was being trained to attack Russia and that Turkey would be brought into the fight against Russia as well, that the Soviets were furious with Washington for not closing down Count von Sciatsky's activities, and that Russia would be very dangerous after World War II, and that no official secrets must be given to the Russian ambassador. Pavlenko told military intelligence officers of G2 on March 18, 1941, that the Nazis were coordinating German, Japanese, Italian, and Spanish spies on the American West Coast through the Ukrainian and other white Russian groups under Count von Sciatsky. He gave the army men lists of names of white Russian spies, and he revealed that a white Russian, as we're going to see, this was an OUN guy, and he revealed that a white Russian who had assassinated the Polish Minister of the Interior in 1935 was being imported to assassinate President Roosevelt. Because of this disclosure, contacts in South America succeeded in liquidating the killer, although they may have simply neutralized him. That is a matter of conjecture. Now, again, note that according to Pavlenko, a white Russian, as we will see, this was a member of the OUN, who had assassinated the Polish Minister of the Interior in 1935, was being imported to assassinate FDR.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In a number of programs, including For the Record, AFA number 10, For the Record 448, and For the Record 602, as well as number 475, we have looked at the 1934 coup attempt against Franklin Roosevelt. Earlier we mentioned General George Van Horn Moseley. He was part of the MacArthur Group within the military. And in the aforementioned AFA number 10, we took a look at his role in collaborating with the Reich intelligence to have yet another assassination, another assassination of FDR to be followed by a coup. Now again, Mr. Pelopenko, mentioned that a white Russian, as we will see, that is a white Ukrainian, who had assassinated the Polish Minister of the Interior in 1935, actually 1934, was being imported to assassinate President Roosevelt. That crime, the assassination of Minister Pieracki, I may be mispronouncing that, P-I-E-R-A-C-K-I, was effected by the OUN. There are a number of sources for that. And I'm going to cite a number of academic journals. Wikipedia has the following about the assassination of Bronislav Pieracki, and it is as follows. The assassination of Bronislav Pieracki, referred to as the Warsaw Process in the Ukrainian historiography, was a well-orchestrated project killing of Poland's top politician of the interwar period, Minister of Interior Bronislav Pieracki. And one more time. The assassination of Bronislav Pieracki, referred to as the Warsaw Process in the Ukrainian historiography, was a well-orchestrated target killing of Poland's top politician of the interwar period, Minister of Interior Bronislav Pieracki, by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, as a retaliation for the government policy of pacification of Western Ukraine, which was carried out by the police. OUN was formed in Poland as an amalgamation between a number of extreme right-wing organizations, including the Union of Ukrainian Fascists. From the moment of its founding in 1929, fascism played a central role in the organization, combining extreme ethno-nationalism with terrorism, corporatism, and anti-Semitism. The chosen assassin, Horyzh, H-R-Y-H-O-R-I-J, Mashishko, M-A-C-I-E-J-K-O, pseudonym Gontaj, capital G-O-N-T-A, was a trusted member of OUN. By the way, I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation. The assassination plan was decided at an OUN meeting in Berlin. Mashishko was supplied with a makeshift bomb and a 7.65-millimeter caliber pistol from OUN leader Stefan Bandera. In the morning of June 15, 1934, Mashishko appeared at the Foksal Street in Warsaw in front of a social club frequented by Pieracki. He waited there for several hours undetected. The minister arrived in his limousine at 3:30 p.m. However, Mashishko's bomb failed. He pulled the gun and shot the minister from behind twice in the back of his head. Mashishko escaped successfully with the help of OUN emissaries all the way to Czechoslovakia and further to Argentina. The state funeral of Pieracki was attended by some 100,000 people, skipping down. The Polish authorities did not realize at first that the OUN was behind the assassination and blamed the Polish National Radical Group, ONR, for it. The mistake had terrible consequences for Poland's political life. As a result of this, the Bereża Kartuska prison for dissidents was formed. Only a year later did it become known that the OUN was behind the assassination of Bronislav Pieracki. The process of the procession of OUN leaders before a Warsaw Circuit Court took place between November 18, 1935 and January 13, 1936. Stefan Bandera, Mykola Lebed, and several other members of the OUN were proven guilty of preparation of the assassination. During the Warsaw process, 16 members of the OUN were tried, including Stefan Bandera and then Mykola Lebed and a number of others here as well, names not as well known to members of the listening audience. Note that ultimately OUN members and the ABN were involved with the successful assassination of JFK in 1963. We have spoken about that in AFA program number 15. Also came back to that in For the Record 777 and 778 and For the Record program number 876 as well. So note again the role of the OUNB and other related Ukrainian fascist organizations with the powerful Axis Fifth Column in the U.S. between the world wars. Note their collaboration with Third Reich intelligence as well as with prominent American fascists like the aforementioned Harry Bennett working for Henry Ford, Father Coughlin, and others. And note again, Alexei Pelepenko, initially working for the Axis, but when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed in 1939, and Stalin collaborated with Hitler in the division of Poland, they lost faith in the will, the political will of the Nazis to give Ukraine its freedom and sought an alliance of Central European and Eastern European states with British and American intelligence. That is the Intermarium. And later, after that, after the Central and Eastern European fascists coalesced into the OUN-dominated ABN, they became a key part of Western intelligence in the Cold War and post-Cold War period. Now, note again in the essay from Covert Action magazine that we have used in the past, Imagined Geographies, that by Marlene Lalouel and Ms. Rivera, it talks about the various manifestations of the Intermarium concept. One of those was an Eastern and Central European economic cooperative program. Note here, again, from the Lauel Rivera essay in Covert Action magazine that we used extensively in the previous four shows. Originally, that Intermarium project grew out of a debate sparked by a report co-published by the Atlantic Council and the EU Energy Lobby Group Central Europe Energy Partners, or CEEP, with the goal of promoting big Central European companies' interests in the EU. The report, entitled Completing Europe from the North-South Corridor to Energy Transportation and Telecommunications Union, was co-edited by General James L. Jones, Jr., former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, U.S. National Security Advisor, and Chairman of the Atlantic Council, and Paweł Olechnowicz, CEO of the Polish oil and gas giant Grupa Lotos. Again, I think the Burisma Corporation, the Ukrainian natural gas company, can be seen very directly in the dynamics that would surround a successful realization of an economic intermarium. Note also the conflict between an illiberal Europe, as embodied in the Intermarium concept advised by people around Donald Trump and by the OUNB elements in control of the Ukrainian national security establishment, and the socially liberal policies of the Western European elements of the EU, where gay rights and minority rights and others are at least superficially acknowledged and enforced. Note also the Eurasian dynamic, because Ukraine was seen as a pivot point, an area the control of which will lead to control of the world island, both the Asian parts of that and the European parts of the world island, being that landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, all the way across Asia and India and China. The Chinese policy of One Belt, One Road looks to unite the various countries of Eurasia via rail and road traffic. That, I think, is one of the things that has run afoul of the West, and one of the reasons that I expect the Uyghur slash pan-Turkist elements, jihadist elements, to figure prominently in the ongoing destabilization of China. I don't think the One Belt, One Road concept advocated by the Chinese is going to sit well or does sit well with the West at all. So I think the concept of Ukraine as a pivot point has resonance with the situation vis-a-vis China. For the time being anyway, China and Russia have grown closer together as a result of Western policy. There is a lot more to be said about this, but again, it was when Trump withheld or attempted to withhold military aid for Ukraine that he ran afoul of the deep state. That's what he did wrong. We'll come back certainly to the pivot point in future shows. However, this is all we have time for in this program. This concludes For the Record program number 1102. Fascism 2019 World Tour Part 12. Further reflections on the pivot point. This is being recorded on December 3rd of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.